Welcome to the Hugo Award-winning Woohoo! SF Squeecast, in which a group of science fiction and fantasy professionals squee about things SF-nal in a never-ending panel discussion of vague positivity. I'm Lynn Thomas, your moderator. Today's episode is for October, and we are joined by Squeecast regulars Elizabeth Baer.
Hi there.
Paul Cornell.
Good evening.
And Shauna McGuire.
Hello.
Catherine Valenti is headed out on book tour, so she's unable to join us today. However, we have a very special guest this episode, which is Ellen Kushner.
Hello, hello.
You may know Ellen as the author of the Riverside novels. The Privilege of the Sword has been recently released as an illuminated audiobook as part of the Neil Gaiman Presents series. And if you'd like to learn more about that, you can go to Ellen's website at ellenkushner.com. So, we want a Hugo, guys.
Way!
And may I just say, as your guest today, that I cannot believe you don't have a special song. You don't have a song. Right, well, right before we went on?
There will be.
Now they will sing the special Squeecast song, and we will all, you know, build up our energy and be ready to do it. Well, there is no Squeecast song. What the hell?
We do have a theme song, but it gets tacked on after we record. So,
does it have words, or is it just that woo-woo stuff that's at the beginning?
It's the stuff that's at the beginning.
No, you have to have a song. Maybe you can have a contest.
I think Sean and Ellen
like
are going to fight now.
Song with the words, "We are Squeecast," in it. All right, I'm going to work on this. Or maybe a contest. But anyway, do proceed as if I weren't here. Which you may soon wish were true.
I think we could put lyrics to "Let It Be," except this would all be copyright, and we don't fancy fighting the Beatles in a copyright extravaganza. But you know, SF Squee, SF Squee, speaking words of wisdom, SF Squee. When I find myself in times, I better actually not recite any more lyrics, because otherwise that will be a problem.
You'll cross the fair use threshold. That's true.
Yeah,
getting us into trouble again, Paul.
That's his job.
Well, actually, that's Shordan's job. I'm more a stunt Shordan.
Oh, that's the best image ever, and I want to get you a wig now.
Could we do that at the Hugos?
We could totally do that next time out.
That would be fab.
Yes, we have a Hugo now. My Hugo is made of glass. The cats have not broken it yet.
Yay! Woo!
And I think that I got sick right after Worldcon because that's part of how I generate pathogens is I build them in my own body. And so I was home when the FedEx man came with my Hugo. And I don't think he's ever been greeted before by a woman covered in blood going, "Gimme, gimme, 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 gimme." He gimmied.
Wait, how sick were you? Most of us don't bleed copiously when we get a cold, darling.
I have a broken blood vessel at the top of my sinuses, which means that if I sneeze a lot, I start getting these amazing, occasionally hospitalizing me nosebleeds, because I'll get blood loss from nosebleeds.
Sean, and you are so special.
Oh, trust me, it's not the kind of special that's awesome, at least in this case. But it means that there's a certain point, if I'm really sick, where I just give up. And I'll just lie there on the couch, sneezing and bleeding and sneezing and bleeding, and take a shower every couple hours to rinse off the thick crust of dried blood that I have generated. And some of you are going, "Ooh, hyperbole," and others are going, "No, I've met her."
And how nice of you to be all dressed up for the delivery man.
And I had bought this pack of white tank tops because my dress, I had to wear a corset with for the Hugos, and so I put on a white tank top and cut the straps off so the corset wouldn't eat my flesh. And I figured if I'm just going to lie here and bleed anyway, Halloween is coming up, I'll put on one of the other white tank tops from the pack and I'll bleed on that, and I'll have something to wear when the trick-or-treaters come. So it was really showing the blood really good. And
efficiency,
I think,
in all things. Thrift ratio.
Yeah, I think I can traumatize the FedEx man.
That was NyQuil logic at its finest, Sean.
I love NyQuil logic.
NyQuil logic is the greatest. I should write all of my stories on NyQuil.
I did love being on stage with you guys at the Hugos. It was like I joined the Justice League. I'm just in, you know, a rather offhand tuxedo, and the rest of you are dressed up to the nines. You looked incredible.
We were Disney princesses from hell.
Paul, all men in tuxedos look incredible.
She's right.
Well, you did see mine of the evening. I look rather like I'd been rumpled and then thrown out of a club down the stairs.
See, I just thought of that as your James Bond post-fight look, so it's fine.
Oh, I like that.
See, mm-hmm. See, there's always a way to parse it.
Yeah, I thought you were channeling your Peter Wisdom, personally.
Oh yeah. See? Pete Wisdom. Mm.
So there you go. All right. Now that we've been tangentially wandering around, I have to drag us back to talking about things. So we should do that. I'm going to go first because I have been waiting like 4 months to talk about this book because we keep running out of time before I get a chance to talk about this book. So I get to go first. Yay! I am talking about Doug Hulick's book Among Thieves, which came out in April of 2011. I read this a few months ago, so it's slightly hazy at this point because been meaning to talk about it for several months. But what I want to say about Among Thieves is that I really, really liked it. This is one of those novels that I think of in my head as quote-unquote a guy novel. There is a plethora of guy characters. This is secondary world fantasy. It's secondary world fantasy set in an urban setting that is fantastical. So it's not urban fantasy, but it's urban fantasy in the old school setting kind of style, as opposed to the marketing category style. And it's from the point of view of essentially a crime boss. A crime boss's flunky. He is Droth, who's the main character, is a member of the Kin, which is sort of the big crime organization, one of the big groups of crime organizations in the city. There's an empire involved that the crime organizations are sort of politely ignored by most of the time until he gets hold of a magical artifact du jour, MacGuffin, that suddenly everybody wants because that will allow you to rule the world, muhaha. And so basically what you end up with is a really great story that opens with Droth torturing someone by breaking all of his fingers in order to get information and sort of moves on from there. It's fairly gritty, but it is not without a moral center. So it's somewhere between... it's gotten compared a lot to Scott Lynch's Lies of Locke Lamora and his other Gentleman Bastards books. It's similar in sort of the veneer sense that, you know, you've got people with moral centers that are not, strictly speaking, right in the center that we would think of as being the center. They have a code, it's just not ours. And, you know, ours varies from reader to reader, obviously. But one of the things I really loved about this book was that the fight scenes are absolutely fantastic. Doug himself is a master swordsman. He actually teaches Renaissance-style swordplay. And you can tell because the fight scenes that he writes are absolutely amazing. The novel itself has a fairly straightforward plot. It trucks along and it does what it needs to do. There are a couple of twists in it that I rather enjoyed and didn't necessarily see coming. It was wonderfully immersive world building without being sort of top heavy world building where it's all description and no character. I thought Doug struck a really lovely balance between the two. I really, really liked it. So that's my take on Among Thieves, and I encourage other folks to read it. I really, really, I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. So, and Doug writes a really pretty sentence too. It's very, Doug's writing is really accessible but it's still pretty in its accessibility. It's that lovely balance between, you know, being, having prose that does a bunch of different things all at once, but not being rendered completely inaccessible or overly florid by doing all of those things. So that's Among Thieves. Has anyone else read it?
I have not read it yet. It's on my list, but I can speak favorably of Doug in general, as he is another one of the science fiction fantasy writers who have escaped from the old and ongoing AmberCon community. And I've known him for many years through that facet of fandom. And I can definitely attest to his creativity, his facility with sentence, and his knowledge of what makes a good brawl tick. So the book is on my list. I have not gotten to it yet. Sorry, Doug. Sorry.
Do you know what I like about the sound of this? Just to be really retro for a minute, I haven't read the book, but I am very, very heartened by the fact that the title sounds like a quote. Because when I was little, all books that were really cool books had titles that were quotes, often, you know, like two words from a longer quote by Shakespeare, and everybody was assumed to recognize it. And so I'm feeling hopeful. And then, you know, by the time I grew up and thought, oh my God, I can't wait to get a really cool quote from something that everybody will recognize and use two words from it and immediately will evoke this entire panoply of poetry and thought. That's gone now. Nobody does that. It's gone completely out of fashion for book titling. But do you think Among Thieves, do you know where he got the title? Is it from There's Honor Among Thieves, or is it just because it's a book with a bunch of thieves?
I honestly don't know offhand. I'd have to read back in Doug's blog to see if the title was something that came with the novel or was something that came out of the process of getting it published. I honestly don't know offhand.
No. Usually you kind of know, or they use it, the epigram at the beginning or something. Mm. I always get it backwards. Is it epigram or epigraph?
And then epigraph.
Epigraph.
Graph. Epigraph. Yeah,
it's
no.
Really,
you shouldn't have to read someone's blog to find this out. It should be part of the pleasure of the book itself, no?
It's really too bad no one uses book titles from Shakespeare anymore.
Well, I think we should start.
She said sarcastically.
No, she did not say sarcastically.
No. You obviously have not been paying attention to Shonen's book titles.
No, that's not fair. No,
I'm seven books into a series where every title is a quote from Shakespeare.
And Bear quotes everybody, including Richard Thompson, which makes me insanely happy. You're right.
Yeah.
Why are our people not following us?
You should look into Shonen's urban fantasies. They're quite wonderful, and they are Shakespearean, at least in their title.
Honey, I'm getting on, and my memory is shot. You're absolutely right, and I apologize. But
that's okay.
I'm doing what you do, because they're afraid of copying you.
No, there are people doing it, and the quotes are so... I love quotes. They're magical. And then people get all confused. They're like, you misquoted this. It's like, no, I didn't. You're missing the point. Everybody is happy until everything is horrible forever.
Or your nose starts bleeding again.
It's not.
I'm glad.
Let's keep it that way.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so the other thing I want to point out about Among Thieves is that Droth is the main character, but he has a friend named Devin, and they have a lovely bromance. So I just, you know, it's nice to see. They're the kind of friends who have really wonderful interplay dialogue that is just deliciously snarky at one another with deep affection underneath. Their bromance is true. So not a lot of female characters in the novel, but, you know, other than that, being a nitpick as someone who looks for that sort of thing, I really enjoyed it. So Among Thieves by Doug Hulick. It's out now. The next book should be coming sometime. But it's totally worth reading. So there
on
you
a
go.
Fantasy schedule.
On a fantasy schedule, yes. It's coming on a fantasy schedule, but it's worth checking out. The next thing on our docket is Bear's selection, which is Vonda McIntyre's Dream Snake, which was which is based originally on a novelette called Of Mist and Grass and Sand, for which McIntyre won a Nebula Award in 1973, and Dream Snake won the 1979 Hugo, and the 1978 Nebula, and the 1979 Locus Awards. So, you know,
it's one of those books.
Yeah.
I'm delving into the classics of science fiction here. I should point out that I first read this book, I don't know, I must have been 8 or 9 years old, which would have been roughly when it came out. And
you were born then.
Yeah. This book is actually as old as my boyfriend. But
that's recent, eh?
Yeah, that recent. I read it as a very young person and fell in love with it passionately. And did that kid thing where you read. My mother believed in providing inappropriate books to young children, so I grew up on Vonda McIntyre and Joan Vinge and. Susie McKee Charnas and all sorts of things that probably that turned me into the adult I am today.
No wonder I like you.
that was what I was reading. You know, I was doing book reports on T.J. Bass's The God Whale in fifth grade. So,
sister,
I got in so much trouble. Dream Snake is just a wonderful little book. So I sat down and reread it again yesterday and discovered that I liked it even better. I think the last time I had read it was in college, but I still remembered it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you sort of wonder if you're looking at a book through rose-colored glasses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Suck Fairy has not visited Dream Snake.
Hooray!
If anything, it's even better and even cooler as an adult. What this book is about is it's a an odd novel in that it's a post-nuclear apocalypse novel that is neither a utopia nor a dystopia. It takes place in a limited geographical area. It's hard to tell exactly where that limited geographical area is because it's been nuked all to hell. But there are people who live in the mountains and people who live in the desert and radioactive craters and other hazards of landscape. And there's also space travel, but the space travel is limited to a very few people. Our protagonist, who is named Snake, is a healer. And what the healers do is they go around on their ponies with these bioengineered, genetically manipulated serpents that they can feed drugs to create anti-cancer drugs or inoculations against disease or various other things. And early on in the book, one of the snakes they use are these alien serpents called dream snakes, whose venom is a powerful hallucinogen and painkiller. So early on in the book, the protagonist's dream snake is killed. She then has to go on a quest to find another one because they haven't had any luck in breeding these things. So basically, they're just occasionally having some success with cloning, and other than that, handing the same snakes down along lineages, with the obvious repercussion that there are fewer and fewer snakes and thus fewer and fewer healers with every generation. It's actually a very brief little book. It's only about 300 pages long. I read it in about 3 hours. It's fast-paced and wonderful. The world building is great. It has all kinds of interesting social structures that are explored with surprising depth for the brevity with which she gets through them. The prose is very clean, very, very wonderful. And you get a real sense of this world and the people in it and their mores and their social development in very brief spaces of time. It's a terribly efficient little book in a way that many books are not anymore. So an enviable novel, and I urge everyone to read it. I don't want to say too much more about it because I don't want to spoil the cool bits. But there is one thing in here that I lifted without realizing it for my Jacob's Ladder books, as Dream Snake must have been the first book I ever read that has a character who has no pronouns.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember that.
There's a character, and Vonda does it so well that you don't notice.
Yeah, you really don't notice.
And there's a character in my Jacob's Ladder books who has no pronouns, which when I came up with it, I'm like, this is great, I'll do it this way. Not realizing that this was, you know, something somebody else had done better that I had read when I was 8 and must have gotten into my head then. So there's a little bit of very cool stunt writing in here too.
So
I highly recommended.
Did you gender the character yourself? I mean, did you just know it was male or just know it was a female?
You know, as a kid, I think I did. As an adult, I think she got away with it.
No, I mean, usually when a character has no pronouns, the reader
puts
them in themselves, and it's always kind of interesting to see who chooses what. And then later you realize it and go, oh, wow. So I was just curious to know.
As a kid, I gendered the character. This time I really, yeah.
You know who else does a brilliant job of that, although she sort of cheats by doing it first person, is it's a mystery novel by Sarah Caudwell called Thus Was Adonis Murdered. Do you guys know that?
Mm.
No.
You would love it. You would love it. Have me back sometime and I'll tell you all about it. But it's another one of these books where half the people who read it don't realize the character was never gendered, and the other half and go, just, well, it's obviously a woman, or, oh, it's obviously a man. And, you know, a tiny percentage go, we never actually know. It's a long trick to pull off.
Scalzi's got one of those too, so does Emma Bull.
Emma Bull,
in Bone Dance.
Really?
Yeah. The protagonist of Bone Dance has no gender.
What's the Scalzi?
Is it in Old Man's War? It's a secondary character with an androgynous name who never gets a pronoun, and it's very intentional.
I walked straight by that.
I did too, because I read Old Man's War and I didn't catch that either.
I think it's in Old Man's War. I don't, you know, that's the it's in that world, and now I can't remember which particular book it's in.
Mm.
But yeah, it's such a great trick when you can get away with it.
Dream Snake is part of why I went into herpetology.
Ha ha!
I mean, I loved snakes anyway, but it was the first time I had encountered a character that was a female that was allowed to be that chill with snakes, and no one judged. It was actually an awesome thing that she had these snakes.
Yes. And so, the boys are scared of the snakes.
Oh, yeah. Which is the sensible thing to be if you have not been trained to handle snakes. And the first time I got tagged over the course of classes, that was part of how I kept myself calm, was going, okay, well, it's a form of medicine. It's a form of medicine that is designed to kill me, but they'll give me medicine to counter the medicine. It'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
I must have read that like 20 times when I was a kid.
Cool. Ellen has brought today Isabeau Wilse's Flora books. This is a trilogy of novels, and then there's some short stories as well, all around a character named Flora. And the second one of those books, Flora's Dare, actually won the Norton Award in 2008. So, Ellen, why don't you tell us about the Flora books?
Okay. Every now and then, I get a book to read that I love so much that I physically toss it up in the air and bat it around like a kitten because I am so overjoyed with it. The one that has done that to me twice is Philip Pullman's Golden Compass, and Flora Segunda did it too. It just fills me with glee and delight. My problem is I'm not the world's best critic, particularly for things I love, and what I tend to do is just toss books around both physically and verbally and tell you how wonderful they are. So it was a bit of a challenge for me to sit down and think, all right, what is so good about this book? I mean, I would just happily go squee, 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 but that would be incredibly boring radio for everyone. So I'm going to talk about the first of the three with the happy promise that there are two more that you will get to read when you read this one and hopefully fall in love with it as I did. First of all, for me, I don't care what's in a book if the language isn't fun and interesting. And Wilse is a terrific writer, just line by line. She's original, she's snappy, she's funny. And when I say snappy, I don't just mean that it's clever and clever dialogue, which goes a long way with me, but also that her language is cadenced. There's just a way that people who got rhythm in their souls write, and I can't read it if they don't. And Isabeau Wilse really, really has this in spades. The other thing that's insanely cool about this is for a long time, people have been complaining, particularly when I was your age, about how all alternative world fantasy was essentially some version of a sort of mythic Celtic or Northern European thing. And why can't we have something that isn't? So people have started delving into other mythologies, but Isabeau has done something that I've seen I'm not even sure I've seen anybody really do this. It's a secondary world that is American, and not only American, but Californian. So not the West, but actually California, with a huge sort of Spanish-Mexican thing. So the place is called Califa, and the place where Flora Segunda lives, and it's kind of California. And the big evil enemies are the Huitzil Empire. And forgive me, Isabeau, if I'm pronouncing this wrong. It's Huitzil. And they're basically the big scary, oh, Lordy, is it the Aztecs? I guess it's the Aztecs. I'm waiting for Shauna to jump in and go, no, you're a moron. That is not who's there. But they're a sort of a fusion, maybe, of Aztecs and Mayans. But they've got the Califans call them the birdies because they wear, and some of them actually have birds' heads. And they have feathered cloaks and big, scary jade masks. And they wield obsidian daggers for ritual sacrifices. And they are the sort of scary evil empire with whom Califa has a partial truce. But it's not set in a specific time. It's got a kind of a 19th century feel, but it's also sometimes got a kind of an 18th century feel. And she totally messes with gender because Flora, the book starts when Flora is about to turn 14. And like the Harry Potter novels, the books take her forward a year. I think it's a year at a time, which makes it a shame that they were published as middle grade books because they move on up through the years. But Flora's mother, who's known as Buck, is a general, is in fact the general for Khalifa, and has to wear a white powdered wig and a tricorn. And it's very clear that she's sort of wearing 18th century military dress, is Buck, whenever we see her, which isn't often because she's usually off at the barracks. There's a huge amount. She's from a military family, so there's a whole lot about military stuff in here that, possibly because of my limited knowledge of military literature and history, does make me think a little of Kipling. I mean, it's got that feeling of, you know, you're really into it up to your elbows in the military culture of growing up in a family where everybody goes to the barracks and everybody is a soldier. The magic, though, I mean, for all that it's snappy and funny and clever and in some ways even satiric, the magic is the real thing. And again, to me, this is something critical in a really good fantasy novel, which is that it gives you that frisson. Often it's played for comedy because Flora is 14 and she desperately wants to wield the words of Grammatica, which is magic, which is not a traditional thing to do in a military family. So she's learning it. She's learning it secretly, very much aided and abetted by a series of cheap paperback novels, which in the Flora books are called Yellowbacks. And the Yellowbacks are all the Yellowbacks. And you know where she got that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here where you go, ah, I know what, you know, Shakespeare play you took that line from. Or, you know, I'm guessing this was from the Yellowback book that poor Oscar Wilde was carrying. But so she throws a lot of stuff like that in. And again, it's like what I love about this is her influences. Her influences are not the standard stuff or the boring stuff. They're all incredibly original, and she weaves them together to this very convincing world. People are always taking tonics. They're Madame Twankey's, cold remover or whatever. Madame Twankey seems to have an enormous number of patent medicine that everybody takes. But anyway, the Yellowback books that she reads are The Adventures of Nini Mo, which is the sort of nickname of the greatest ranger of all time, a woman named Niana Keegan, known as Nini Mo. And Nini Mo is full of wise quotes that are always helping Flora to get through difficult moments. And they are simultaneously, am I still here?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
They are simultaneously, very funny and yet very empowering. And in fact, I just read somewhere online some woman who said she was going through cancer treatment and kind of used the Nini Mo quotes to help her get through. The one that's the most famous is Dare, Win, or Disappear. But can I read you just a little tiny section here?
Sure.
So that you can hear the wisdom of Nini Mo and the cleverness of Isabeau. So Flora Segunda... Oh, and I should explain that the reason it's Flora Segunda, which may not have been the most felicitous title for a book, is because she's the second Flora in her family. She's the second daughter named Flora in her generation, because the first one was killed by the Huitzils when her parents, which is her mother, Buck, who was not at that time a general, and her father, who is known as Hotspur, because he was just a terror, a redheaded terror of a, forget if he was a colonel or what, and has been broken by after his capture. But the first Flora in the family was killed, and so she is the second Flora. And the part of this book is just about her identity of who she is, because she's not Flora Prima, she's Flora Segunda, kind of like being Flora Junior. So anyway, Flora and her best friend Udo have gone off and attempted to do something very foolhardy, and it has gone crashingly wrong. Nini Mo was not in the military. The great Nini Mo was a ranger, who were these sort of magic-wielding, mysterious, endlessly inventive adventurers. So Flora and Udo's plan has come crashing down. Rangers do not always meet with success, but they don't let failure stymie them. They regroup. Of course, rangers didn't let themselves be jacked like stupid, idiotic greenhorns. "Don't dwell," said Nini Mo. "A ranger always thinks again and regroups." I thought and thought, but my thinking was not regrouping. My thinking was running around and around the idea that Nini Mo would have done some extremely clever, daring deed and saved the day, turned the steely girl into a pretzel or kicked her in the nose, bedazzled her with another paper, or charmed her with flattery. It's only after it's all over that you start thinking of all the clever ranger things you could have done, only when it's too blasted late. And this is Ellen again. I have to say that I completely concur, and I'm feeling that way right now about being on the Squeakcast. Except for the part where I tell everybody how great Flora Segunda is, because I just love this book. So Udo says, I say that you yield to my plan now, Udo said. Yield to your plan, Udo, I said incredulously. You must be mad. After what just happened, I wouldn't yield to your plan if it were the only plan left in the entire history of plan. And they go on, and they have an argument, and I won't tell you what happens, but here also her twists and turns are just remarkable in this book. So I love it to little bits, and I hope I've begun to convince other people of it. There are these three books, Flora Segunda, Flora's Dare, and Flora's Fury, but she's also written some amazing novellas for adults set in the same world and with the same characters. So she also has what I think of as the Anthony Trollope thing, where there are some very mysterious adults in this book, some of whom are dead, but they are the leads in some of her adult novellas, and that just makes me incredibly happy too. Have you guys read these or any of these?
I have not, but you have intrigued me.
Yes, these sound very relevant to my interests as someone who deals with dime novels and orange-backed novels on a regular basis.
This okay, it's not Oscar Wilde, it's orange-back?
No. Yellow-back is another term, but yellow-back mm-hmm. tended to be, I think, the British versions, which were also called penny dreadfuls.
Yeah.
Orange-back is not actually a technical term. They're just often referred to in the U.S. as dime novels because they were sold for a dime.
Okay.
I'm also reminded of the old yellow-spined Daw science fiction and fantasy books.
I was thinking of the Glance yellow hardbacks, actually.
So everybody's got a yellow book.
Somewhere in their past.
Yes, somewhere in their past, or a series of yellow books.
Oh, I left out the best part. Oh, it's just so good. That Flora belongs to a great house called the House of Firdraka, which is going downhill rapidly, in part because the house's butler, who is the magical being who takes care of this 1,000-room house, has been put away by her mother, who doesn't want there to be magic. But when you find out what the other great houses and their butlers can do, and you visit them, it's just totally scrumptious. And again, it's this wonderful, again, I would say almost, you know, Trollopian combination of strange little domestic details and yet huge, numinous craziness of magic that the best fantasy gives you, but just knocked together in a way that I just have never seen anybody else do. I just love them to bits. I can't get enough of them. And they also, they reread really, really well because they're really densely layered and there's a lot more going on than you realize during your first read. So no complaints.
Cool.
Yay. All right. Does anyone have anything else to add about the Flora books? Okay. What we're going to do now is we're going to move on from Flora and Udo to a band called Ludo. How's that for transition? Woo.
Impressed.
Thank you.
That was very Seussian of you.
Yeah, you know, I have my moments. So, Seanan, why don't you tell us about a band called Ludo?
That actually makes it sound like a children's book. Like, a band called Ludo. Let's go into the forest. So, Ludo is, they're a geek rock group. They're originally off the East Coast. I keep trying to describe them to people. It's kind of like what you get if you crossed They Might Be Giants with Ookla the Mock. And unfortunately, this causes most people to look at me a little bit blankly. They're like, okay, that's awesome. Whatever. They are so weird. These are the weirdest people I've ever encountered. They've got some music videos you can watch. I want to dance to one of their songs at my wedding. It's called The Horror of Our Love. Fortunately, anyone who is likely to marry me would think this was a good idea. Their first album is self-titled. It's called Ludo. For the most part, it is not their strongest material, because how many bands can really say that their first album was their strongest material? Although one of the songs on that album, Lake Pontchartrain, is one of my favorite songs of all time.
I know that song.
Yeah, let me tell you how it happened. It was Darius and Nolan and me, that one?
No, I know a completely different one.
Yeah, no, it's great. It also means I can spell Lake Pontchartrain, which makes people who live near there really happy, because that's a word just packed with frightening silent R's. The follow-up to that, which was called You're Awful, I Love You, is really getting much more into the shape of who Ludo will be. And You're Awful, I Love You, which is one of their first singles, is also one of the albums they've done a video for. They did it in a single continuous take. It is fantastic. Their front man is a white guy dancer in that he understands that he has no rhythm, so he just rolls with it in a terrifying way. Just fantastic. And that's Andrew Volpe, who writes most of their work. He writes most of their songs himself, for which I am very appreciative because I love his lyricism. You know, I just adore the way he approaches things. They've also done an EP called The Broken Bride, which is a rock opera. That's kind of what you would get if a bunch of kids were hanging out and were like, I want to play Jurassic Park. No, I want to play The Time Traveler. No, I want to play Night of the Living Dead. Okay, we're going to do them all at once. And then they turned that storyline into a completely awesome rock opera, which is a little terrifying. And I'm not really sure how I feel about that even today, but is the reason that you will sometimes see me wearing a shirt that says I Pterodactyl Ludo rather than I Heart Ludo. Their most recent album, though, which it came out in September of 2010, it's called Prepare the Preparations. There are these things I chase through the world that are called perfect albums, an album where you're just like, there is nothing on here that shouldn't be here, even if some songs are stronger or weaker than others. It is the fact that they are together and the order in which they are placed that gives them their power, that makes them a perfect album. And Prepare the Preparations is a perfect album. There are songs on it I like better than others when I'm listening in isolation. But just in terms of I want to sit down and listen to an album, it's one of maybe five that is genuinely perfect. It has the best geek love song I've ever heard. It's got just this amazing mix of genres and moods and approaches. And I recommend it wholeheartedly to pretty much everyone. My favorite band since I was 14 has been The Counting Crows. They were my college band. I used to sneak into the Bears Lair at UC Berkeley to hear them play when I was way too young to be in there. I went to UC Berkeley partially because it was the Counting Crows alma mater. Like, I acknowledge that my choices in life are very frequently inappropriately influenced by media. And when I was in New York most recently, I had the opportunity to see both Ludo and the Counting Crows live. And I had never seen Ludo live before, so I was very excited. We saw the Crows. Great show. Absolutely fantastic. Two nights later, went to see Ludo. I came out of there looking kind of shell-shocked, and my agent, who had gone to see Ludo with me because she's my agent, kind of looks over and goes, what's going on, honey? You look kind of weird. And I'm like, I think Ludo is my favorite band. Because they are so fantastic, and they edged out the Crows, which I did not think would be done while there was still flesh on the skeletons of this world. And just to give you an idea of what kind of people these are and why they are our people, when we saw them live, I could practically have dictated that set list. There were maybe three songs on there that were not my favorites of their songs. And they were all things like Girls on Trampolines, which are big hits for them, as big hit is measured when you're a relatively small indie geek rock band. So I understood why they were there. And they do all of this, and they go away, and they come back for the encore, and we're all kind of sitting there going, what the hell can they do for an encore? They have run through every hit they have. And they are in a room full of worked up, drunk geeks that will fall upon that stage like piranha with thumps if they don't do something great.
Did you just say piranha with the mumps?
With thumbs.
Oh, thank you.
Isn't that the scariest concept ever? I'm a piranha and I can open doors.
Yes. No.
And so we're just like, we're all kind of sitting there waiting to see what the hell are they going to do that will cause us not to kill them. And their synth player starts going, nee, 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 what are they doing? Which would be when one of the two electric guitarists comes in with bum ba na na da da, a room of 250 drunk geeks screaming Ghostbusters. Maybe the best endorsement I have ever seen given to a geek band. They are amazing, and you should totally just go and download Prepare the Preparations. I'm not sure it would be everyone on this Squeakcast's favorite album. I think Paul will really prefer The Broken Bride, and I'm reasonably sure that Lynn will be happier with Your Awful I Love You. But Prepare the Preparations is a flawless album, and if you want to see if it's actually a band you can enjoy, that is where to start.
Okay. Has anyone else heard any... is anyone else a fan of Ludo?
I think we're all about to be.
Yeah. It sounds like we're all about to head ourselves over to our music vendors of choice to purchase some music.
I love the fact that Sean had specific albums suited to our personality type from this band.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous about that.
Yes. I wonder, when I listen to that album, what that will say about me from her. Which was it? The Broken Bride.
The Broken Bride, which is it's a 5-song EP. It's actually what got me hooked on Ludo, because a friend of mine stuck a couple of those songs on a mixtape she made me. And it's actually an example of their lyricism. There's a point, it's a song about the zombie army that is marching on this city and is going to kill everyone. And they're trying to get the people worked up to go and fight the zombie army, because our pop music should have deep meta meaning here. And, you know, you've got the primary lyrics going. There are actually three different lyrical chains going at that point. And the counterpoint, the lyric that they thought mattered least in that moment, is there's a time to fall and there's a time to fight. Anything can be a weapon when you're holding it right. And that's just worked in there. It's like, we had so many good ideas that we didn't even have to put this center stage. You know, if you can pick it out of the mess, good on you. They're absolutely brilliant. I could not love them more.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you, Shannon. All right. The last thing we're going to talk about today before we interrogate Ellen with our silly questions is Paul's selection, which is Dan Dare, the British science fiction comic hero. So, Paul?
Dan Dare was the lead feature in The Eagle, an extremely colourful comic published in Britain starting in 1950. The original run of Dan Dare was 1950 to 1967, illustrated and originally written by a guy called Frank Hampson, who is one of the great unheralded geniuses of comics. The strip was originally scientifically looked over by Arthur Clarke, who seems to have done nothing except giggle. However, what really does strike home about these? This is the story of Colonel Daniel McGregor Dare, born Manchester 1967, of the Interplanet Space Fleet, which is a United Earth body of people in lovely green caps and uniforms who go out into an entirely inhabited solar system, discovering the various peoples that live there and encouraging them to join the United Nations. It's a product of the last vestiges of the British Empire / Commonwealth. It's an extremely optimistic, just post-World War II vision of what a lovely future would be if the human race could get together. It's kind of a pre-Star Trek, except everybody's British. Everybody's British. There's a carefully chosen international gang that go with Dan on his luxuriously drawn exploits, including, fabulously, Hank Hogan, the token American. Hank is a cliched American with a buzz cut and those little glasses, and it just shows the pole of the world that in 1950 the world was still just about revolved around, that we could have a token American representing in what's otherwise an entirely British strip. If you want to take a wander outside of privilege, go and look at Hank Hogan in those early Dan Dares. It is a luxuriously drawn world. It's a world of great spaceships that look something like ocean liners, where all the technology has been thought through, and it's extraordinarily baroque. Google images for Frank Hampson Dan Dare, and you'll get some lovely, beautifully drawn pages. He's a very realistic artist. He actually employed models. And so the various lead characters are all incredibly well characterized and sometimes look approaching photorealism. It's a very lived-in world as well. Dan's Batman, Digby, is from Lancashire, and sometimes we cut back to what his aunt in Lancashire is doing, and there's a tremendous futurism of her cottage where she lives that is full of modern futuristic devices which have big sort of 1950s bumpers to them. This sounds silly, but it's worn really, really well, I think, because it's informed by the experience of actual World War II. That when Dan and co initially go to Venus and meet the Treens, who are led by the Mekon, there's no sense that they are to some degree a race of whom they're all the same. But swiftly we discover individuals and individual attitudes and differences, and it's about encountering the other and saying, well, we're for fair play and all working together under the United Nations. How about you? And the Mekon, who is one of the great villains, that this is all still vaguely remembered in British culture. The Mekon and Dan Dare, people will know what these things are still. The Mekon is all brain and no heart. He is literally a little green man with an enormous head who flies around on a little chair. He wants to rule in a despotic way. And Dan is a representative of a grand democracy. There's a lot of violence, very little killing. But one of my favorite moments is when Dan's crashed. They've got very little hope. He's with a cadet. And he can see that there are two aliens standing in front of a weapons cache on a downed spacecraft. And he tells the cadet to look the other way. I'm about to do something awful. And goes into the ship and shoots the two aliens dead. We don't actually see it. And gets the weapons and comes back with them and arms the cadet. And it's just a really grim little moment. And he takes absolutely no pleasure in it. And he himself is horrified by it. And you can tell this is written and drawn by people who 5 years before had been in a war. There's also a wonderful 1950s feminist icon, Professor Jocelyn Peabody, who looks fantastic with her still 1940s style hair. She is the romantic interest of absolutely nobody in the strip, because this is British adventure comics and nobody's having any romance at all. Mm-hmm. She is there to be all of science. She represents science. And she's also kind of... she's the one who will get them out of the trap by saying, you know, you see that rock over there, if we just move that and all that. And she knows karate, she skis. There's very much an attempt in a 1950 way to say that she is absolutely somebody who should be on this adventure. You know, she's not somebody who happens to be on it. She was sent on it. She's very much there to fulfill a professional function. Some of the loveliest art occurs when a spaceship arrives from Alpha Centauri and powers into the solar system, upsetting everybody's ideas of what physics is. And it's a beautifully mysterious sequence. The ship is designed with an entirely new alien sense of design. Every planet in the solar system has its own design sense and its own way of building buildings and spaceships. It's a tremendous body of work. The strip ran from 1950 until 1967. That is to say, it ran until Dare's actual birth date in the fiction. and was revived in the 1970s in 2000 AD, who really didn't know what they were doing with it. And Dave Gibbons did some good work later on. It was revived again in the 1980s under Grant Morrison, who made it really grim and gritty in that 1980s adult comics way. And then again more recently by Garth Ennis, in a very grim but rather grand and getting the point of it. Garth is known for war stories, so it was a nice big space war story. The thing about Dan Dare is that it's not grim and gritty, but it is real. Dan is an absolute epitome of the fair play Englishman. And as such, he isn't the most rounded of characters, but he's also a real character. He's got, ethnic roots and a place where he was at university and people he likes and friends, and you'll see him in downtime. And all in all, it's more effortlessly adult than a modern approach to such comics would be, in that these are all real people who have real lives and have a very, very real civilization. It's still all available in a series of wonderful hardbacks, and it's a formative influence on me, and I think I recommend it to anyone. I've gone on far too long there. Anyway, Dan Dare, have a look on Google. It's good.
Yes, but you gave us lots of time to go online and start looking at art while you talked. It was wonderful. Thank you.
Doesn't he have fabulous eyebrows?
Yes.
Fabulous. Oh.
I'm actually really pleased that you brought this, because my exposure to Dan Dare had been the 1977 run in 2000 AD.
Which had very little to do with anything. It was almost as if they'd got
I was so confused, Paul.
Yeah.
Because you're like, I'm bringing Dan Dare, and I'm going, really? are you sure about that, Paul?
It's kind of they just miss it. It's one of 2000 AD's big failures, actually.
Yeah.
Mainly because they can't deal with somebody who's just a straightforward hero, and they want to change his entire, what the look of the whole space, what his whole civilization is. And actually, when Igor Comic, his original home, returns in the 1990s. They actually bring back something a lot more similar to the original strip in a non-nostalgic way. So obviously there was a way to do it in a modern way, and 2000 AD missed it.
Yeah. I was just so confused.
He looked a bit like David Bowie in that version, actually.
Yeah, he really did.
That must make it even more confusing. Okay. Do we have anything else we'd like to add about Dan Dare? All right. It is that time in the podcast where we get to grill our guest. So, Ellen, are you ready for the questions?
No.
Well, you have to answer them. Yeah, that's true. But you get to answer them anyway. So here goes nothing. The first question, which comes from Paul, is what do you most fear?
Oh, being ignored.
Okay. Shauna would like to know, can I have a cookie?
Yes. But not if it makes weird crap happen on my internet, on my wireless connection, and clogs up my machine. Then you cannot have a cookie.
Not That's that fair. Kind of cookie.
Oh, okay, yes.
Shauna has a cookie policy.
What is it?
Well,
I don't know.
She wants cookies.
Oh, yeah. That is my cookie policy.
Fair. Who am I to stand in your way?
Okay. Shannon's other question is, what's the first book that you remember reading on your own initiative?
Oh. Actually, I do know the answer to that. I thought I didn't, but I think I do. It was probably James Thurber's The 13 Clocks. Which just explains so much about me and my writing. My uncle gave my dad, probably a first or early edition of The 13 Clocks when I was two. And I had my father read it to me over and over and over again. And my guess is that the second that I could read it on my own without having it read to me, that that was the one I grabbed. It was either that or the original James Barry, Peter and Wendy, ditto. I mean, that is some very weird and wonderful stuff, very different from the Peter Pan you may know from Disney movies or what have you. It's got to have been one of those two, because that was what was lying around. And those were the books that I was already obsessed with and kind of couldn't get people to read to me enough. Mm-hmm. I don't actually have that memory. I wish I did. I remember the first time I ever told a story on my own. That I have quite a clear memory of. My baby brother was being diapered and taken care of, and I kept saying, "Mommy, tell me a story, tell me a story." And she wasn't having any because she had to look after this infant. And so she finally turned to me and said, "Why don't you tell me a story?" And I remember stopping, and I was absolutely galvanized. I think I was about 3 and a half then. I was absolutely galvanized with the notion that I could tell a story. And we had these children's curtains that had the gingerbread man on them. And I remember looking at them thinking, "I will tell the gingerbread man." So there it was. But I don't remember the first book I read.
Okay. Paul's next question is, what have you done today to make me feel proud?
I got out of bed. I didn't want to, but I did. Are you proud?
I'm slightly proud. the pride meter just twitched.
I didn't say anything mean to anyone when I went shopping, even though I was tempted to.
Oh, okay.
I'll work harder tomorrow.
You know, really, it's meant to be a generic. Me. It's not me. I'm not sitting in judgment on you. I'm sure that was fine.
Oh, I thought you had a pride meter going. Oh, okay. Well, never mind then.
You're not sitting in judgment on us?
Well, no, not on a regular basis. Oh, I can if you want.
Okay, good, because otherwise I didn't destroy Wisconsin yesterday for nothing.
I'm glad I'm the brake on your genocidal activities.
I take this all, you can see by now that I take this all terribly seriously. I'm giving you the most honest answers I possibly can. I can change that. I didn't know the rules. I have this Thomas the Rhymer streak in me that's very, very...
Very, very few people have taken that hurdle so thoroughly. It must be said. I think you've taken away the hurdle and taken it home with you. It's fine. It's fine. I'm proud.
Tell us.
Okay, let's go to the next question.
Do you have any more questions like answered? We just quit while we're at it.
Oh, we got to finish them. The next one comes from Bear, and it is, what do you want on your tombstone?
Oh, heavens. I should have prepared, and I didn't.
Is that what you want on your tombstone?
That's a pretty good tombstone, actually.
I can't. I'll tweet it. I'll tweet it when I know, and then you can retweet it. How's that? It's best I can do. Sorry.
Okay. The next question from Bear is, what is your favorite joke, and you can feel free to tell it, and it doesn't need to be clean.
Really?
Really?
Well, generically, my favorite joke is whichever one I can remember the punchline to, because I am one of those people who hears jokes, laughs uproariously, swears to remember, and then forgets. I tend to like kind of conceptual jokes, and the one that I can always remember that's short, as opposed to the one I can remember that's insanely long, is the one where two carrots are driving down the road. Oh, God, now I'm really worried about the judgment meter. This isn't the funniest joke in the world, but this, it does have its place in my heart. So two carrots are driving down the road, and already I just want you to see, you know, their beautiful green tops blowing back in the wind because, of course, they are driving a convertible. And they get a little overexcited, and something happens, and they crash. And one of them escapes with, you know, with minor scrapes. One of the carrots escapes with minor scrapes, but the other one is rushed to the emergency room. And after hours of surgery, the doctor comes out and says, "I have good news and bad news." And he says to the carrot, The good news is he'll live, but the bad news is he'll be a vegetable for the rest of his life.
Oh. I'm saving that one. I'm saving that one for my godsons when they're a little bit older.
Yeah. Well, it is a very sophisticated joke that you need to have some years under your belt to truly appreciate. Thank you for laughing.
Okay. Kat's question is, what is your quest?
To rid the world of mediocrity, except where housekeeping is concerned.
So I'm looking around at my bedroom that needs to be dusted and nodding in agreement.
There we go. I mean, we have to have standards.
Yes, yes. Okay.
And they have to not include cleaning.
Yes, yes. There's two questions left, and they're both mine. What is your favorite guilty pleasure?
I would have to say that, like Shannon's cookies, I am guilt-free.
Nice. And what is your favorite word?
I don't tend to have favorite words. I just love them all. I'm just a complete word slut. But for today, I have chosen gravura.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of our podcast. So it's the time where I get to do the little playing us out and thanking people. So thank you to all of our listeners for joining us. Thanks to our regular contributors, Bear, Shannon, and Paul, and our guest, Ellen Kushner. Special thanks to our webmaster, Dmitry Zagadulin, our technical producer, David McCone Chase, Jeff Bonoff at Mystic Fig Studios for the instrumentals of music by Shauna McGuire, Katie Shuttleworth, who made our rockin' logo, and Michael D. Thomas for general administrative support. We hope that you will join us next time, same squee time, same squee channel. Bye-bye.